Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 1:31 p.m. on Tuesday, April 12, 2022. Present today are Representative LeBon, Representative Josephson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon, we will revisit our discussion about the Port of Alaska. We had the municipality before us about a month ago, and at that meeting, we heard from Jacobs Engineering about this important project and what it entails, and then we heard from the Bronson administration about the financing. There were several outstanding questions about the financing, so we brought them back before us today to represent their numbers and to answer questions. At 1:31, we were joined by Representative Ortiz. So it looks like we have everyone on Teams today. Welcome back. If you could please state your name, affiliation, and go ahead and begin your presentation. And also at 1:31, we were joined by Representative Johnson. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, this is Mayor Abe Bronson. I want to thank you for having us here again for this important discussion on the Port of Alaska. As you know, rebuilding the port is the highest priority for my administration. But Anchorage cannot do it alone, which is why we need the state's support and have come to you with a specific ask of $600 million for cargo dock number one. With me today are Ross Griswold and Colby Hickel, and on the team's meeting is David Ames. Ross will go over the financial aspects of the presentation, and Colby and David will be standing by to assist in answering any questions you may have. Thank you for this opportunity. Ross?
Thank you. Let the record reflect at 1:32 p.m. we were joined by Representative
Thank Yale. You, Mayor Bronson, Colby, and David for being available, and Chair Merrick and others of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come back and discuss the Port of Alaska and the financing plan with you. I distributed a 14-page PowerPoint presentation yesterday, and I presume you all have that, and I am on page 3 at this time.
Thank you.
Page 3 is the table of contents, and the reason we have the bold fonted discussion in the center there is because that's the main focus of the meeting today. There's some other points on here that we'll discuss because they have been questions that we've incorporated into the presentation along with our responses. So I'm going to move to page 4. Page 4 is the Port of Alaska Modernization Program, and we have highlighted here the cost of each phase of that program. It's a total program cost of $1.8 billion. And again, the main reason we're here is what is in the blue highlighted box. It's phase 2B, as in boy, which is the cargo docks replacement. Compared to the prior presentation, we had phase 2, and it was several different items, but we've split that now to make it a little easier to grasp, and we've split it into phase 2A and phase 2B. And so phase 2B is just the replacement of the cargo docks. There's cargo dock 1 and cargo dock 2, and the total cost of just replacing those cargo docks is $1.1 billion.
Great, thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you. Be glad to take questions along the way if there are any. I'm going to skip to page 5, if I may.
Yes, please.
The program has a variety of sources of funds in addition to our request from the state of Alaska. We are ambitiously pursuing earmarks with Alaska's congressional delegation. We are looking at the port infrastructure development grants, which we've been successful at in the past. We are looking at the Rebuilding America infrastructure grants and the recent Investment and Jobs Act that was passed recently by Congress. Those are the grants that we have on our radars that right now that we're ambitiously pursuing. Absent full funding by grants, which is certainly what we anticipate, we will complete that funding with Port of Alaska revenue bonds. Now, one item at the bottom is I've listed as MARAD settlement funds. Now, we have as you know, been in a lengthy multi-year litigation with MARAD, and it's coming to a close, although it's still in the legal process, and the timing and amount of any funds due the municipality are subject to appeals and further legal process. So we've listed that as the last item here, and again, it's still in the litigation process, although we understand that we have prevailed in court, and it's in the court's it's in the hands of the court to determine an award. On page six, we move to phase 2B, and that's the cargo docks replacement. And I say we move there because we're going to focus on the $1.1 billion today. Cargo dock one is estimated to cost $643 million in total. The $600 million request was originally based on, and still is based on, the cost of construction for dock one. The other $43 million is comprised of design, engineering design, permitting, and project management office expenses. Again, for a total of $1.1 billion. Cargo dock two, which would be built second, of course. In this case, there's a logical order. We would build dock one first, and then we would build dock two second, and the total for the two docks is $1.1 billion. I move to page seven. The proposed source of funds for replacing the two cargo docks is sort of in the lower right corner there. The municipality has on-hand funds of $222 million. The state of Alaska request from the municipality is $600 million, and the federal funds, and we would pursue the difference between those two amounts and the $1.1 billion with regard to federal funds, funded grants, and that's $281 million, and that brings us to the total of $1.1 billion. I take that chart and I put it on the next page, page eight. It's sort of a repeat, but it's a little more detail on the municipality funding. We have some revenue bonds that we, authorization for revenue bonds doesn't mean we've sold the bonds, but we have authorization to sell them when we need to sell them. We don't sell debt until we need the money, but we have authorization from the assembly, and that's the important thing. That provides us with budget in addition to any grants that we receive either from the state or from the federal government.
Great, thank you.
Again,
let the record reflect.
Yes.
At 1:37 p.m., we were joined by Representative Edgman, and at 1:38 p.m., we were joined by Representative Rasmussen online. So please continue.
Thank you very much, Chair Merrick. And again, at this point, the municipality has funded 20% of the cargo dock replacement. The $600 million would represent 54% of that cargo dock replacement program, and federal grant funding that we will pursue represents 26%. Any shortfall in either the state or federal funding would be supplanted by Port of Alaska revenue bonds. Happy to go on to page nine. This is where we talk about what happens to the tariffs under different scenarios. The first scenario that we're looking at here is with state of Alaska and federal contributions, a carryover from the prior page where we would receive a proposed $600 million from the state. We have $222 million with the municipality and federal grants of $281 million. The current tariff under tariff 9.0 is $3.30 per ton. That tariff would increase to $7.83, which is an increase of $4.53 per ton and represents a 1.4 times increase in the per ton charge. There's a little math I did in the middle. It's on each page. I've taken out 82 cents for a tariff we added in 2020 for the bonds we sold in 2020, and then I've rolled it all into the third bullet point there, the surcharge per ton increase for required revenue for all the debt service in this scenario. The important thing to remember about a tariff is the tariff is applied and charged as the tonnage crosses the wharf or the dock. Everything that crosses the dock is subject to the tariff, regardless of where it goes in Alaska. Hence, it is very difficult to quantify on an item-by-item basis what the tariff impact is on any particular item, regardless of where it goes in Alaska. And that's why we've looking at it strictly here on these scenarios on what the tariff increase is on a per-ton basis. On page 10, this scenario is with the proposed contribution from the state of $600 million. No further state or federal grants are assumed, and the municipality would have to borrow $503 million to get up to the $1.1 billion that's necessary for replacement of cargo docks 1 and 2. This results in a net increase of $9.52 per ton, which is almost three times increase over the current tariff, and the new tariff would be $12.82, up from $3.30. Moving to page 11. In the event that the municipality is on its own and solely funds the cost of the cargo docks replacement, we would borrow $1.1 billion. The current tariff would go from $3.30 up to $23.48, which represents over a $20 increase per ton and a 6.1 times increase over the $3.30. These tonnage numbers are based upon 2021 actual tonnage that crossed the port, as well as 2021 revenues that was that were received by the port.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This is kind of a small point, but I just kind of want to point it out.
Bear with us for a moment, Chair and Representative. Let's try that.
Okay. Go ahead.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And it's just a small point, and it's more of a labeling, but I'm on page 11, say, or even page 10, and you have your current tariff at $330, and your final new per ton cost is $23. And I know, I understand you're looking at just the increase, but if you go from 3 to 23, it's about a 700%, seven times increase, because you're saying six. It's just a nomenclature thing, but I guess when you go from 330 to 1282, that's typically a 400% increase, not a 2.9. It's a small detail, but I guess it just depends how you identify the increase as not a portion of your. You're not including the original fee in your times increase, but I'm just being picky.
Okay, thank you for pointing that out. What I did, Representative, is I took the difference between the new cost, which is $10.34. I subtracted the $330, which is the existing tariff. Let's see, 1282. I'm sorry, I took the 1282, which is the new tariff, and I subtracted the $330, and I came up with $9.52. That's the increase over the $3.30. And so what I did was I divided the $9.52 increase. I divided that by 3.30, and that's how I came up with 2.9. So it's 2.9 times 330 to get to 12. If you take 2.9 times 330, you end up at 12.82. Again, it's semantics. I agree, sir.
Yep, thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, sir, for the question.
Thank you. Please continue.
I believe we talked about page 11 already, and that's if the municipality funded the cargo docks replacement on its own and borrowed $1.1 billion. That's a 6.1 times increase over the $3.30 for the per ton charge for tonnage coming across the dock. On page 12, this question has been asked as well. It's not just about the cargo docks here. It's about the entire program, Port of Alaska Modernization Program. The entire PAMP is $1.8 billion. If the municipality funds this solely on its own, we would need to borrow an additional $1.6 billion in addition to what we already have on hand, and the cost per ton would increase from $3.30 up to a new cost per ton of $33.05. Again, the difference is $29.75, which equates to a 9 times increase over the $3.30. I'd go on to page 13 and summarize our presentation here. The municipality of Anchorage owns the Port of Alaska. We have an obligation to maintain a giant asset like that belongs to us as well as the state, basically. And the obligation further extends to maintaining that port so that it can transfer food and goods throughout the state of Alaska, or most of the state of Alaska. And so our request for $600 million to the state, again, I mentioned it was equating approximately the approximate value of $600 million of construction for Dock 1 in this cargo docks replacement. So we feel that we feel comfortable that in asking the state to share in that reconstruction of what is the Port of Alaska and dependent upon by all Alaskans. The request for $600 million is where we are here, and the municipality would continue to pursue the other $503 million from other sources of funds that we have. Any grant shortfalls that we come up with, as I may term it, grant shortfalls, we would replace with port revenue bonds, and consequently we would have to charge a surcharge per ton to accommodate the debt service requirements of investors. The contribution provides the needed funding for cargo docks replacement of Phase 2B of the PAMP. The Port of Alaska is a tsunami-proof port, unlike any other port in Alaska. And if there's questions about tsunami-proof, I'm going to refer to David Ames, of course. But it makes sense that we put a lot of money into this port, which we are doing now. In order to enter into contracts for Phase 2B to complete the cargo dock replacement, we must have designated or committed funding sources for the entire amount by 2025. The dock is built as one continuous dock, although it's called Dock 1 and 2. But we have to, in this day and age, in order to commence with a project like this, we have to have funds identified for the whole project before we can begin to let contracts on a project this size. Replacement of Dock 1 will provide food security for the residents of Alaska. And I'll be glad to take any questions. And Mayor and Colby, perhaps you have some closing remarks that you might like to make.
I have none at this time.
Cool. Thank you very much, Chair Merrick and other members present for your time today. I'll be glad to answer any questions as we have David Ames here, Colby, and the mayor.
Great. Thank you very much. This is Representative Merrick, and I have a couple of questions. My first is, you said that you need the funds committed by 2025. So would it be feasible to, say, give $300 million this year and $300 million next year? Is that doable?
Well, The urgency of the port here is, Chair Merrick, is to secure all the funds that we need as soon as we can. That way, we're comfortable, once we have the committed sources of funds, we're comfortable letting contracts and carrying on with the project. There are a couple of evaluations going on by David Ames of Jacobs, where the project could actually move ahead a little faster depending on certain characteristics of the final design that he's in the stage of making. And your question is a good question. Our desire is to get the funds that we can as soon as we can so that we have total funding for the cargo docks replacement.
Great, thank you.
But to answer your question directly, our objective here is to secure 600. If it came in two tranches, if we had to do that, we certainly wouldn't turn down the second tranche of $300 million. We simply need to get this done. But as you understand, in the world of finance, securing funds as early as you can creates stability for the overall project, both the financial side of it and the engineering side.
Thank you, Mayor. And Chair Merrick, that's an excellent point. We're going to be grateful for whatever we may receive now or in the future.
Great. Thank you very much. And my second question has to do with the increase in tariffs. Just to kind of put this in perspective, on page 11, your example shows if the municipality were to have to borrow all the funds, 100% of the funds, that it would go from $3.30 to $23.48. Can you give me kind of a rundown on how much that would increase a consumer good? So say a gallon of milk, how much increase would that be for the consumers?
Well, if I may, Chair Merrick, I mentioned earlier that it's very difficult to quantify the impact on a gallon of gasoline, a gallon of milk, a pickup truck going to Fairbanks, or other implements or goods going elsewhere in Alaska. What's easy about it is it's a per ton charge on the tonnage that goes across the port. And we at the port and the state, we really don't have control of what the users do with that increased tariff and how it will impact individual items. It's difficult to equate that on a bread basket or a market basket at the grocery store or a pickup truck or other material that comes across the port. It's something that is, it's just something that we haven't gone to that point where we want to try to quantify that because it would really be mere speculation.
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, my question is about the state's commitment to the Kinnickarn Bridge and Toll Authority. I have some memory of our committing $200 million as part of a bond, but that money or that opportunity is occupying space in our sort of debt service capacity and is unused. Do I have that right?
Representative, I missed the first part of your question.
Representative,
are you
through the chair? I guess what I'm wondering is, I'm trying to think in a sort of transparent way, I guess, about how to package this in a way that people might be most receptive to. And I have some memory of our having, the state having authorized a Kinnickarn Bridge for $200 million through our bonding authority. It's not happening. And am I right about that fact? Let's start with that.
There was at one time, I do recall as well, something about some funds being appropriated for the Kinnickarn Bridge. That's unrelated to the Port of Alaska. And if those funds were appropriated for the Kinnickarn Bridge, which which and if that project is no longer feasible, then that money could be freed up, but it comes back to the legislative body. And it is separate from the Kinnick Barn Bridge is totally separate project from the Port of Alaska Modernization Program.
Right, and I understood that. I'm aware of that. But I just think it's an avenue we need to look at. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm going to inquire about the engineering design and construction. Is the construction contract being developed before the engineering and design is completed? And as far as the construction itself, are you looking at sole source construction on the two phases in question?
David Ames, please.
Mr. Ames, if you could place yourself on the record. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Ames, PAMP program manager from Jacobs Engineering. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, but am testifying remotely from Colorado Springs today. Through the chair, Representative LeBon, the current plan for the construction is to do a traditional design, bid, build construction. So the engineering and design would be done, followed by a bid process. For a competitive bid process for construction. There is no intention at this time to go sole source for construction. We are considering alternative construction or contracting strategies such as design build efforts, but at this time we have not determined to move ahead that way. But it is expected to be a competitive process regardless of whether it's design-build or traditional design-bid-build.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So regarding the detail of engineering and design, how far along is that? Are you near completion? Do you have additional work to be completed that's going to take the balance of the year? What's the timeline on the final engineering and design of this phase?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, the process, the design of the cargo docks is in what we call the conceptual stage right now that will take it to about 15% design level by this summer, and then the preliminary design stage roughly by the end of the year. At that time, the preliminary design is being done by Jacobs. At that time, the 35% would be design would be bid out, or proposals would be solicited to perform the design of record services and complete the detailed design by a third-party designer. That would take it to 100% design roughly by the end of 2023. At which time it would be bid out, construction proposals would be solicited.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Johnson.
All right. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I had a couple questions on your funding source. Well, let me just start with my first question. I'm trying to get a sense of how much of this is replacement and how much of it is expansion. So if you would speak to, and I'm talking about phase one and phase two, are you just rebuilding what's there under phase one, or is there any expansion to what you already have?
Mr. Ames?
Through the chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the name. Is it Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Okay. The current plan is to design, basically it's a replacement of in kind of the structures. Due to equipment upgrades and slight modifications of the technology that would be used for for materials handling and cargo handling, there would be a potential expansion via efficiency increases. But as the terminal is planned out now, it would be a replacement in kind of the two cargo docks.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And so in the potential expansion, that's not factored into this at all? I mean, as far as your design costs or any design that has expansion in it?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, there is, especially for Terminal 2, there would be a capability to expand, say, to a different type of operation. If you'll permit me to go into a little bit of detail, Terminal 1 is a rail-mounted gantry crane operation. Terminal 2 is a roll-on, roll-off operation. The intention is to design Terminal 2 with the ability to expand to a rail-mounted gantry crane operation in the future if necessary. If that's, I think that might be what your question is directed at. So the terminals are being designed with the ability to expand, but there is not expansion. There is not an expanded capacity, with the exception of efficiency increases, built into the design itself, as the business case hasn't dictated a need for that at this time.
Thank you. And another question, then moving on from that, is so the way you have it set out here, we have 222 million is municipality funds that's already authorized, their bonds already authorized. So under the current authorization, how long will it take you to sell the bonds that you already have authority to sell? I mean, I know that requires having a bit of experience in municipal bonds, and time-wise, how long does it take once you have the authorization to take it to get your bond issuance and your money in hand?
Chair Merrick and Representative Johnson, the most important feature about the revenue bonds is we go to the assembly and request authorization to sell revenue bonds when we need the cash. But what the authorization to sell the bonds does is it gives us budget so that we have a committed source of funds and that we can let contracts and begin spending money. And then when we need cash in the form of bond proceeds, then we would sell a series of bonds, perhaps one bond every 18 months over the time frame that it takes to rebuild the cargo docks. And that can be there is no timing requirement on when we sell the bonds, but the most important thing, as I mentioned, is that the authorization to sell the bonds gives us budget, and that's our source of funds. And then when we need cash in the bank, we would sell bonds to basically reimburse us for expenses. So the concept is we need sources of funds that are committed to the project, and that's a little different than actual cash sitting in a bank account.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. I think there is a time to do some of those things. But in this case, you have authorization for $222 million, and you have about $40 million unaccounted. Unauthorized, is that, or no, you have authorization for about 180, right, it's in here somewhere, but
that's approximately, yes, Representative.
And then you would have to go to your assembly then to get the additional $40 million?
Are you on a certain page, Assemblymember Johnson?
No, I'm just reading all of them, but I can go back and take a look here. I think,
hey, Jade.
Probably page 8.
I'm sure you're more familiar with your PowerPoint than I am, but
Chair Merrick and Representative Johnson, you want to turn to page 8? I believe that's where your perhaps saw the 40 and the 8180?
Yeah, I actually was thinking that I saw somewhere it said you had 180 some million already authorized.
182.
Not yet issued.
On page 8 of the presentation, under the first bullet, municipality funding, we have a short-term borrowing program that authorizes $40 million. We have revenue bonds authorized for $182 million. They are not yet issued.
Yes. So do you have full bonding authority for your total amount for municipal funding?
Well, what we have right now is for the $222 million on the top of page 8, we have full authority for that and have actually received some of the money already. We sold bonds in 2020. So any difference that we need would cause us to go to the Municipal Assembly for further authorization.
Is there a time? How long does that usually take to go to the Assembly? I mean, it could be done overnight, I suppose. I mean, if you call an emergency meeting, but typically how long does it take between when you decide you're going to have some?
Chair Merrick and Representative Johnson, to go through the assembly process, it takes 5 weeks, 4 to 5 weeks, because we have to have it to the assembly a week ahead of time. We have to introduce it at a public assembly meeting, and then a couple weeks later, we have a public hearing for it, at which time we anticipate the assembly would take action. So it's 4 to 5 weeks to get further authorization.
Representative Johnson.
Thanks. I guess what I'm trying to get a sense of is you're asking us to fund this before you have full authorization from your assembly, even for your amount that you're saying is the assembly amount. I mean, the amount that the municipality is going to provide.
Well, on page 8, Representative, we have $222 million of authorization of funds in hand. Our request for the state of Alaska is $600 million. Now, the difference between those two numbers and the $1.1 billion is $281 million. Now, we are intending to pursue every avenue of federal grant funding to secure $281 million, which would give us complete committed funds and a complete source of funds for the $1.1 billion. And as I note at the bottom of the page, it's an important footnote that in the absence of any state or federal grant funding, we are going to request the Municipal Assembly for additional revenue bond debt issuing authority. So in this case, we already have $222 million. Were the state of Alaska to appropriate $600 million, and we didn't receive any federal grants, which we think is an unlikely case because we believe we will receive some of them. But in the event if we didn't receive any federal grants, we would go to the Municipal Assembly and ask them to provide us with authorization for the $281 million. Now, once the Assembly authorizes that $281 million, which we certainly believe they would because they are every member is in full support of this project, that doesn't preclude us from accepting further federal grants that would come after the fact. So if we had a federal grant that came in for $100 million after that, then we could reduce the amount of debt that we would issue by $100 million. And perhaps we would only have to issue $181 million. So another important feature is just because we have the authority to sell the bonds from the assembly doesn't mean we have to, because we will make every effort to replace that authority for revenue bonds with further federal grants.
Representative Johnson.
So some of that money, if say, You did get extra money. None of that would go back to the state. I mean, we're the first ones in here, And then on top of that will be potentially a sliding amount as far as how much the city puts in, depending on how much they get from the federal government. Anyway, I wanted to ask you another question on, I still haven't, and I guess I should have done a little more research, but I'm trying to figure out how the Port of Alaska is the only tsunami-proof port in Alaska.
David Ames, please.
Mr. Ames.
I'm assuming they knew this was coming.
Through the chair, I got part of the question due to a bad signal. Could you repeat the question?
My question is, are you still standing by the statement that the Port of Alaska is the only tsunami port, proof port in Alaska? And I guess, and I'm obviously, and I hate to be comparative, but I mean, I don't think the port in Port McKenzie is very far away from that port.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Johnson, what I can say is that it is the only tsunami-proof general cargo port in Alaska. Port McKenzie is a bulk port that is not suitably equipped to handle handle general cargo or containers. So I think that's the statement I can make.
Ah, okay. So you're saying that it's not that it's the only tsunami port proof port in Alaska.
It's
cargo. You're saying that
it's
the cargo.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes, it's the only tsunami-proof port that could meet the food security requirements that are the target of this project.
And if you could just elaborate a little bit on those points.
Through the chair, yes, Representative Johnson, if you look at the berth at Port McKenzie, I could actually put up a presentation that shows the aerial photo of the port. The port is laid out as a bulk loading port, right? It was designed to load wood chips, I believe initially. The berth is occupied. It's not a flat platform that allows for the rapid transit of trucks that would require either for a RoRo or a Lolo container operation. There is a large ship loader on it blocking any traffic to the terminal. And of course, there is a lot of talk about the berthing complications there due to navigation issues or due to high currents and climate conditions that affect the berthing there and make it difficult for certain vessels to berth there. But the from an engineering perspective and from an operational perspective, the facility there is not a cargo loading platform, or excuse me, a general cargo loading platform. It doesn't have the facilities to unload the type of cargos that are required to meet the food requirements of the state.
So I'm not going to get into long detail about this. I would probably I'd beg to differ, but otherwise it would take a long time to do a point by point analysis. I do have some concerns though. I mean, I can guarantee you if we go to a $23 tonnage fee, there's economics says someone's going to find a way to make sure that doesn't happen because there's a facility that's easily used close by that can be used for that. So I guess my concern is we're talking about getting the state in for $600 million before we have the full financing in place. And I know that there's other issues, but I'm not sure if we're talking about an expansion, if we're talking about just fixing what is the problem right now, which we know that the Port of Anchorage has issues. We know that, and no one wants to see that shut down. But I mean, we can talk about. I don't want to go long into more detail because I think we have other things to work on today. Thanks.
Thank you. We have questions from Representatives LeBon, Rasmussen, Wohl. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And following up on that same line of questioning from Representative Johnson, I get a sense that time is of the essence, that sooner than later is the ask. So if the state contribution fell short of the $600 million, I think the number was suggest maybe half. If that came in several allocations, maybe $300 million now and the rest of it later, would the municipality move forward with the total financing with the state's contribution at, say, half of the $600 million? Would the municipality go to its assembly and ask for the difference so that the total project is funded, if you will, sooner than later? Would that be a strategy you've considered, or am I getting ahead of yourself?
Yeah, through the chair, this is Mayor Bronson. Yeah, the port's going to be built as soon as possible. We're going to do literally whatever it takes to get it built to include all forms, and that's government money and private equity. We've got offers of private equity, but then we start losing control of the port. That could be good or bad, but we need to get the earliest money as soon as possible from the state and certainly from the municipality. And then we have an idea we're meeting with the delegation. We were in Washington 2 weeks ago. We met in Senator Murkowski's office today. I mean, this is an all hands on deck effort in our office, in our administration, and with the assembly to get the money we can, because we're going to stack all kinds of portions of this, and it's called stacking. And the $600 million is in that stack. $222 that we've got available, which is actually comes up to the $455 if you include phase one, which is just completed. We have to do this. This is when we met with representatives of the DOT in DC 2 weeks ago, they'd already gotten our briefing, and then they looked at it from a DOT standpoint, and they says, I use the word an existential threat to the state. They say it's a humanitarian crisis the moment that thing falls over. That's their words, not mine, the Department of Transportation. And everyone is willing to get this done. We're just trying to piecemeal this together. But if necessary, the citizens of Anchorage, we're going to have to get this done one way or another. I hope that answers the question.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think my question might be best suited for Mayor Bronson, and just want to thank everyone for being here to present today. But Mayor Bronson, is there any ability or mechanism for the municipality of Anchorage to recover costs when we know that 80 or 90% of the state uses or, you know, benefits from the goods that come through the Port of Anchorage? I guess I'm concerned that if we end up in a situation where Anchorage ends up having to bond more, you know, with the state not sharing as much equity in the project, when we know that a good majority of the state benefits from the port, I just don't want that cost to fall solely on the taxpayers of Anchorage in bond debt.
Well, there's two portions of that, and I'll answer first, then Ross can answer the bond portion of it very simply. When it goes to tariffs, that's the portion repaid at the cash register, whether it's here or Bethel or Nome or wherever. The bonding thing, I'll let Ross answer the bonding payback. Pretty simple concept, I think. Ross?
Right. Representative Rasmussen and Chair Merrick, the tariff that's charged, the tariff is charged as the tonnage comes across the dock, and then once it's across the dock, it ends up in anywhere in Alaska, pretty much, from the North Slope down to South Central, of course. And that tariff that we charge pays the debt service on the bonds. So the municipality is the issuer of the debt, doing business as the Port of Alaska. Now the taxpayers of the municipality, they are not technically responsible for the debt. It's the investors have a lien on the revenues of the port, and so the port and the municipality are obligated to set tariffs, surcharges, fees, what have you, so that we meet a minimum revenue requirement to pay debt service and other covenants that are associated with the debt. So it's not really on the backs of the municipality's taxpayers. It's really a surcharge on the users on a proportionate basis, probably, and then they can allocate, as I mentioned earlier, to what's in the containers.
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate that. I guess in speaking to the line of questioning from Representative Josephson a little bit earlier, as far as the state debt capacity, if we were to do, you know, 150 or 200 million or 300 million of, I guess, hard cash essentially, and then 200 million where we have unused capacity for the Kinnick arm, is that something that would still help the municipality, or is it, are you guys only looking for cash at this time?
Chair Merrick and Representative, as the mayor has pointed out, we're going to be extremely grateful for whatever we can accomplish in a grant from the state of Alaska. And if it happens to be over a two-year period of time, you know, that would certainly work for us. Now, if, for example, there's X million dollars or $200 million that has been appropriated by the legislature for the Kinnick Arm Bridge, and that project no longer exists, that money, and I don't know exactly how it works, but that money should revert back to the legislature, and then it's unrestricted assets of the legislature to do whatever they wish to do with it. And were it to be an addition to appropriation this year or next year to the Port of Alaska, that would probably be doable, and of course up to the legislature.
Just one more quick follow-up, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, and through the chair. So it's my understanding that we can take on debt if the legislature approves it, and we would have to expand from just the Kinnick arm to include the Port of Alaska. So it wouldn't necessarily be reappropriating funds. I guess it would just be the ability to lend money or borrow money. I'm not sure where interest rates will be. I guess that would be a factor, but I do think that as the committee moves forward in deliberating how we assist this project, it's something worth considering, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The numbers we're looking at, 600, 222, 281, did the 222, I imagine, is sort of fixed based on what the municipality has, and did the 600 come, was that sort of the where'd that number come from, I guess, is my question. And the 281 follows the other two numbers? And if so, is the 281, I mean, is that, do you think you could get more than that in federal grants?
Representative Wohl and Chair Merrick, I'm looking at page, you're on page 8, of course, but let's go back to page 6 for a moment, if I may. The cargo dock 1 is listed here as costing $643 million. Now, the construction cost, the material and labor to construct it, is estimated at $600 million, and that's where the original $600 million came from. Now, the 43, that's in addition to the 600, that's design, permitting, and project management office expenditures and costs that are associated with Doc 1. So hence, the total is 643. But the 600 came from a number that was associated with the construction of Doc 1, because with the construction of Doc 1, we can use Doc 1, and that provides food security for Alaska. And then once that's accomplished, we move down the line, down this continuous dock, and construct dock number 2. And beyond that, David Ames would be glad to answer that, anything further on the construction process here. But back to page 8, if I may, which is where you started, Representative Wohl, the $222 million is in hand. Our request of $600 million leaves $281 million on the table for the total of $1.1 billion. We're pursuing every means we can with the federal government and the various grant programs they have to supplement this project up to the to achieve an additional $281 million. If that $281 million does not materialize in any amount, or whatever amount it does not materialize, the difference will be made up by the Municipal Assembly for revenue bond authorization.
Representative Wohl.
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful. I guess my question sort of was, could there be more than 281? I understand there could be less. There's a lot of federal grant programs that were listed, IJA money, and I don't know what the scale of that available pools of money are and who else is, obviously everyone's competing for it. But I didn't know if 281 was achievable or was a big reach, or, you know, could you get 481?
Chair Merrick and Representative Wohl, the recently passed act by Congress, even the application process is yet to be determined for that, and the other processes are for the build for the RAISE grant and the PIDP grants, for example. Those are processes that happen typically annually, and there's some amount that we can achieve for that. And if it does achieve more than $281 million, it would be dedicated to other phases of the PAMP. David, would you like to add to that, please?
Mr. Ames.
Through the chair, and thank you, Ross, Representative. The based on meetings in Washington last week, it seems that what we have heard, especially from the DOT, is that the $250 to $300 million range is a reasonable range to be targeting for a project of this size, given the legislation that has just passed. Now, obviously, that's not a guarantee, but those are good signs that we took out of our meetings in Washington.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you. Thank you for that last question. There's been talk of this food security cargo dock capability, and that this port would have that capability to meet quote unquote food security needs. Are there any other ports in the state of Alaska, as Representative Johnson alluded to, regardless of tsunami safety, status, if they're tsunami proof? But are there other cargo docks that also meet this food security capacity, or is this the only one, and it just happens to be tsunami-proof?
I guess I can answer that, I think. We have to design and build based on where things are at right now. We've got a trucking hub, an airport hub, a pipeline hub. All the infrastructure that goes with the port is already in place. Now, in an emergency, if we had an earthquake, say on this side, not on the Prince William side, but an earthquake here, we would be tsunami-proof. But as we all know, the last real major earthquake in 1964 devastated those ports on the other side of the Chugach Range. Well, we wouldn't want to, I guess, develop those properties right now as part of this, because the earthquake that destroys this dock is the other one, is the one that could also wipe out those docks. But the tsunami portion of it is not the threat here. That's why we're, you know, maybe that's why it was here in the first place from 100 plus years ago. I don't know. But all I'm saying is that this dock here is tsunami proof. It has all of the infrastructure that we need. And keep in mind, this is just a replacement. The entire thing is a replacement. All we really did, and David can confirm the number, but we moved the dock out about an extra 140 feet into the water, into the current, and that's just to, I believe, David, accommodate for a little deeper water and therefore larger ships. And it was really that simple. But if you were to take a satellite view of the current dock and the completion of this, it's going to be almost identical. If David, you can feel free to correct me.
Sure, Mr. Mayor. Madam Chair, shall I?
Yes, Mr. Ames.
Respond. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Representative Wolf, the mayor's correct. What's missing from other locations is the infrastructure to distribute cargo, correct? So while there are a few deep water ports in Alaska that could potentially unload cargo, though not to the level and volume that Anchorage can, there is no distribution infrastructure to distribute it for the state through the state, and that is the primary advantage of Anchorage. The tsunami advantage, the tsunami protection that is afforded by being up into Kinnick Arm and protected just by its geography from tsunami is just one of the advantages of the site in Anchorage. The primary one is the one that the mayor mentioned, which is the infrastructure to distribute throughout Alaska.
Great, thank you. Anything further? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair. So, has anyone given any thought to the fact that the bridges would be down if we had that kind of earthquake? I mean, how are we going to get, I'm just thinking that road system-wise, we're going to be cut off from the rest of the state. That would be something I would really like to investigate as well when we talk about earthquakes. But what I really wanted to ask is on cargo dock number one, if we take everything else out and we just talk about cargo dock number one, how is the funding, how is the $600 million applied to cargo dock one?
Ross?
Sure. Representative Johnson, through the chair, Mayor. I'm on page six again. Cargo dock replacement, there's two docks, and it's my understanding, and David will elaborate as needed, that in order to build these two docks, we really need the funding in place for both of them, but cargo dock one would be reconstructed first. The construction cost of cargo dock one is estimated to be $600 million. The difference, which is $43 million listed on page six here, that's dollar amount has been estimated to take care of the design, permitting, reviews by the Corps of Engineers, project management office, all the other things that kind of go on in the background versus the actual construction of the dock itself. Does that answer your question, Representative Johnson?
Johnson, thank you. Well, I guess what I'm trying to tease out of here is that $600 million that we're talking about appropriating here going to fund cargo dock one construction, and it doesn't really get into the cargo dock two would be financed through municipal and other federal funds. It looks like we're the first people in, and not only that, almost the only person in if we're looking just at cargo dock one.
Well, through the chair, Merrick and Representative Johnson, if you look on page 8, you can see that the municipality has already committed funds of $222 million. So those funds are in place now as we speak. Then we have another, and then we have a request, which is the second bullet on this page, of $600 million. Now, together, those two are $822 million. And of course, the difference is the $281 million that gets us to the $1.1 billion. So the $220 million is already there in hand, and a source of funds is designated and committed. And we're seeking at this point $600 million appropriation from the state in the form of a grant. And that would equal $822 million, which is greater than the dollar amount for Cargo Dock 1, which is $643 million. Does that help, Representative?
So what I heard is there was $600 million plus the design of construction costs plus $43 million for planning and design, and that the $600 million that we're talking about appropriation here would go to Cargo Dock 1. And if that's not the case, and it's actually a lesser amount for Cargo Dock 1, then that's what I'm wondering.
Ross, Madam Chair, I can...
Yes, Mr. Ames.
If that,
please.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I think Mr. Riswold's slides make clear that we actually need $1.1 billion committed to the project as a whole before even starting the Cargo Docks project. Starting the construction, I could say, because the planning is already going on and is already being funded and has been initiated. So the total ask and the total need is the $1.1 billion. So there will be $1.1 billion committed to the project before construction starts. The ask is coming from the need to establish food security. I don't know if I would necessarily look at it as the state's money being spent first. It's all going into the pocket that purse that has to be committed before we can begin construction, and maybe that helps as a way to look at it. But I think there will be a combination of funds going into various parts of this project as it moves forward.
Representative Johnson.
My understanding is Cargo Dock 1 was going to be built and then begin construction on Cargo Dock 2 to allow for the port to stay open through all of this. So it sounds like there are two different projects or two phases, but are in trail to each other. And that's why I'm trying to figure out if we had talked about in the, I think, a previous conversation that it would have to sit for 4 to 6 years. I mean, it would take 4 to 6 years to do the construction, that then Cargo Dock 1, I guess, would be 4 to 6 years before we need the second part of these monies. And so the $600 million would go to either it would be sitting in a pot somewhere, a portion of it, because I haven't really figured out what even if we have one large pot of money to begin with, there is going to be something that's attributed here, because if we don't have to sell the bonds until we need the money, then the money that's going to be used would be the money that's available, and that would be the $600 million going towards the Cargo Dock 1, and then the second half would be built, closing whatever they have to close and then starting the second cargo dock. I'm just trying to get a clear picture of how the money is going to be put towards each of these phases. And if what I heard was that the $600 million would go to the first cargo dock one, and the $43 million, the design and planning, would be what would be picked up otherwise.
David, let me make a take a shot at this through the chair, Representative Johnson. There's a construction project, and there's also a financing project. I'm trying to get it down to a level that I kind of understand it. Nothing gets built until we have $1.1 billion committed. That's and we're trying to fill. David used the purse. The purse is going to pay $1.8 billion. But to start that project, the $1.8 billion project, the whole thing, we have got to have $1.1 billion in the bank before the first piling is driven. And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to stack state, local, and federal money to get to 1.1. And we're not done at 1.1. We still have a ways to go after that. But the construction of the money project, not the construction of the dock, that's what we're talking about here. And we're just trying to fill that purse to a minimum required level to even begin construction. And when someone explained it to me that way, then all of a sudden things started to make sense.
Okay. Final follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Mayor Bronson. I'm familiar with municipal capital projects, and I just am doing my due diligence because I'm concerned that the state is putting ourselves in the first position in this project, and I have some concerns with that.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, thank you so much to the municipality mayor for being here and folks.
Thank you.
And with that, we are going to take an at-ease until 250, where we will return to amendments on Senate Bill 9. So we are at ease until 250. At ease. House Finance back on the record at 2:52 p.m. And please let the record reflect at 2:15 p.m. we were joined by Representative Thompson. We will be returning to amendments to Senate Bill 9, Alcoholic Beverage Control, by Senator Michicki. We began our amendments this morning. And we are at Representative Wohl's amendment number 19. Representative Wohl, do you have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Can I move Amendment 10 first?
Amendment 10 has been moved. I will object for discussion. Representative Wohl on Amendment 10.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Amendment 10 basically acknowledges the four live events that were requested for tasting room, brewery and distillery and winery tasting rooms, and prescribes that they're one per quarter instead of any time, day or night, or any time of the year. And the reason for this is quite simply that, again, I'm just trying to put a little sidebar on those that are in the entertainment business and the business of booking shows and music and events, that those in the manufacturing of alcohol with tasting rooms, to not encroach on that other business, in that, for example, in the summertime, as Representative Josephson mentioned, that it's nicer weather, and a lot of times concert promoters and the like will try to do concerts during the summer months, and this is the only time someone can do outdoor shows, and as to sort of keep it, those that are making their living doing that, to have not have the tasting rooms do all theirs, for example, in the summer, but they would space it out one every 3 months so they could do them all during the year, but one per quarter. And I've discussed it with others involved in the bill, and they seem okay with it.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just see this as being completely over-restrictive, and I think that we're overstepping as the role of government. So if it's for a year, we should let people manage at the time they see fit to have these events, and it's too prescriptive to go down to one a quarter. So I'll be opposing this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will echo the comments from Representative Rasmussen. I would rather the businesses have flexibility to schedule as they wish, and I can only imagine an outdoor concert in Fairbanks in January. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion on Amendment 10? In wrap-up, Representative Wohl.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm not trying to be overly government over prescriptive, but you know, we have rules, we have limits. You know, you can only fish certain times of the year. You can't go out and pull fish out of rivers or hunt and whenever you want just because the public wants that. This is a licensed business with controls for a reason. You know, some people would like any access to everything all year long, but again, the people that have BDLs that are allowed to have music, are that's one of their privileges, but now when other people have that privilege, it encroaches, and I mentioned mission creep earlier, and this is something that I didn't think was met with objection by people in the business itself, in the manufacturing business. No, you can't do an outdoor concert in January in Fairbanks. I agreed. But as someone who's done hundreds upon hundreds of shows, I've certainly done many in January indoors. And I think there's facilities here in Juneau, for example, that I've been to that have indoor facilities and would be happy to do them indoors. But that's all. I'm just trying to get one per quarter just to make it a little better for those already in the business.
Thank you, Representative. And before our vote, Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if there were any questions for me on this particular amendment. I actually don't have a problem with this amendment. I think it's reasonable. If you think about how, if you kind of in your mind's eye look at a calendar, you could have an event in March, you can have the rest of the summer to schedule others, and then you just have the last quarter where you can have one earlier. I don't have a lot of heartburn on this particular amendment. I think it's fair. I think the bar can manage their schedule anyway. So I just wanted to make that clear. I don't have opposition to this particular amendment.
Thank you, Senator. And with that, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Yeah. Representative Lebon has objected. And with that, Madam Clerk, would you please call the roll?
Representative Lebon.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
Pass.
Representative Rasmussen.
No.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Wool.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Edgman. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Pass.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Josephson.
No.
Representative Merrick.
Yes.
Three yays, six nays.
And with a vote of three yeas and six nays, Amendment 10 has failed to be adopted. Representative Wool, Amendment 19. Is there a motion?
I move Amendment 19.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This amendment addresses the number of events a nonprofit can have and sell their own alcohol. It's in current law, current law right now is five events per year, and honestly, this amendment here on line three shouldn't say instead of insert four, insert five, which is current law. So I guess I need to amend my amendment, and probably best to do that now, I suppose.
So amendment one to amendment number 19 is on page one, line three, change the word four to the word five. Is there objection? I'll object for purpose of discussion for Amendment 1 to Amendment 19. Further comments or questions?
Thank you. Yeah, I guess the 5 is the current law. It was raised in Senate Finance of the year 2020 up to 10, and I want to bring it back to current law, which is 5, which is the number of events a nonprofit can have where they don't have to have a catering permit. And I'm not sure if anyone knows what a catering permit is. It's been talked about in this committee a little bit, but if you sell alcohol, if you have an event you want to sell alcohol and you don't have a license to sell alcohol, you can get someone who has one, a local bar or restaurant, can get what's called a catering permit, and they take the privilege of their license to the event. We see them here, for example, at Skits. We go to Skits at Centennial Hall. There's a few bars set up where you can buy alcohol. Those bars are run, and the license is of a local establishment in town. It may change from year to year as to whose it is, but they take their license, they bring it to that establishment, they set up a bar, they submit an application to the ABC board, they have a diagram of where everyone's going to be and where alcohol is and where alcohol isn't. They sell the alcohol so that patrons at that event have the ability to buy alcohol. Sometimes that there's an arrangement between the license holder who sells the alcohol and the organizer of the event, and maybe they exchange some money. Here, you can sell alcohol at my event, and then you give me a certain percentage of the sales, which is beneficial to both people. That's a catering permit, and that's what happens at most events where there's alcohol in an establishment that doesn't have a license. And the legislature goes to a lot of these events for receptions, and sometimes if they're at like a hotel that has a license, it's not a big deal, but if it's at a, you know, Juneau City Museum right next door, you'll see them there. And there's usually someone there that has a license that either sells the alcohol. Now, a nonprofit can do 5 events a year without a license. So they can have an auction or they can have a fundraiser. Let's say it's the local concert association or the local whatever nonprofit can do these events and not have to get someone with a license. And they bring it in and they can keep all the money. And they can do that 5 times a year, which is current law. It's been in law since 1980. This amendment raises it to 10, which is almost one a month. And I guess my two thoughts are, if you're doing 10 events a month.
The amendment does not raise it to 10.
The amendment lowers it. I'm sorry, the amendment lowers it to 5. The bill raises it to 10.
Correct.
The amendment
Thank
that
you.
Was in Senate Finance of a couple of years ago. Yeah, I'm sorry. The bill currently says 10 per year. My amendment will lower it back to 5, which is current law, which has been in law since 1980. So I'd like to keep that. I feel if you're doing 10 events per year where you're selling alcohol, you're kind of in the alcohol business. 5 is a lot, but I'm not going to change the law. So if you're doing 10 a year, you're in the alcohol business, and there's a license you can get for that. Also, if you're doing 5 a year and you need somehow to do more, you can cater it, get someone else to come in and cater it. But I just think 10 events a year, you're not a nonprofit for whatever. You're kind of in the alcohol business. And lastly, again, we're talking about devaluation of licenses. Catering permits is a good source of revenue for someone who owns a liquor license. There, a lot of times when I had one, people would approach me and say, hey, could you cater this event for me? I've done events at the fair, because at the time the fair in Fairbanks, and currently the fair in Fairbanks doesn't have its own liquor license. They'd have to have individuals come in and sell at the fair. A lot of times they'll need someone for an event. At a big outdoor concert, not on my property, but they'd say, we're doing a concert here, can you cater it? I would bring my license and cater it. So it's a good revenue stream for licenses. The more of these catering permits that aren't happening, the less value the license has. So
Representative Bull, I just would like you to speak to amendment number 1, which is changing the word 4 to the word 5.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was talking about the whole amendment.
Yes, you were.
Amendment number 1 to amendment number 19 changes 4 to 5. 5 is current law. I want to keep it a current law.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Discussion about amendment number 1 to amendment 19. Hearing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment 1 to amendment 19 has been adopted. Now we are at amendment 19 as adopted, or as amended, pardon me. Okay, Representative Wool, and then Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I pretty much said everything I need to say about amendment 19. 5 a year is fine. That's been the law for 40 some years. I know there's a couple nonprofits that probably want to do something every month, but I think to do that for everyone is excessive, and I think if you're doing 10 events a year, that's a little mission creep from whatever nonprofit you're in. Suddenly you're in the alcohol business, and I understand it is lucrative, but I think 5 is a good number, and I'd like to keep it there.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for the maker of the amendment, given his background in the industry, if a nonprofit were to hold a fundraiser at the Juneau City Museum, would the nonprofit be responsible from a liability point of view if they overserved an individual and there was a problem post event, or would the Juneau City Museum be responsible?
Representative Wall.
Through the chair, Representative Labana. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty confident that we take a lot of classes in alcohol serving, and those of us with licenses, all our employees, and even the owner of the license has to take the class every so often. I believe the person serving the alcohol ultimately would be responsible, and if a nonprofit is doing these events, I imagine they have all their servers, TAMs trained, and you know, they get a little card when they take the class to say they've done all the requirements to understand how to serve alcohol and to tell when someone's had too much. You know, usually the license holder holds a lot of responsibility. So if a nonprofit were to use their nonprofit status to host an event, I would think, and there wasn't a license holder involved, I would think the responsibility would fall on them.
So Senator Machicki, do you have a more firm answer on that by chance? We do not have legislative legal online. If you could place yourself on the record, please.
Yes, thank you. This is Senator Peter Machicki from District O. You may have seen me around on this bill from time to time. I'm looking at some notes. The reality of it is, being involved with several nonprofits through the years, is the venue does not take on the liability of licensing associated with this. It's strictly with, so you have to have the wherewithal as an organization. It wouldn't be a local neighborhood event. It would be a well-established 501c3 that can meet all the requirements and have the required folks that can do the serving and everything else.
Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess a follow-up to that question would be, would that nonprofit be expected to place an insurance liability for that event to protect itself in the event something went wrong? Is that in state statute that they must have an insurance policy?
I really don't know. I don't know what is a part of the application process. What I will tell you is typically usually larger organizations that have riders for events, and typically it's not alcohol related. It's somebody slipping on the steps before they enter into the, you know, these are typically not drunk fests. They're usually a Boys and Girls Club or Girl Scouts or some other smaller event, but not, and some of them are larger. I know there's been some museum fundraisers and for various larger organizations, but I'm unaware of any problems coming about from this in the past that are related to liability. I think it's covered as liability is for any other kind of event they put on, whether it has alcohol or not.
Thank you. On this point, Representative Wolf.
Yep, thank you. Through the chair, when I had a license, I had to buy liability insurance for my slipping and falling. Also had to buy liquor liability insurance, which is particularly related to a liquor. Someone driving a car, someone injuring themselves or others. Liquor liability is very expensive. It's sometimes hard to get, depending on what kind of establishment you have. So to answer Representative LeBond's question, I don't know, and I'm not trying to throw anyone under a bus because I don't know, but the procurement and purchase of liquor liability insurance is not simple or cheap, and my guess is a 501c3 that's doing a fundraiser at the museum and, you know, selling a little beer and wine, my guess is they probably didn't go through that whole process because it is expensive. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. I was just curious if the maker of the amendment was aware of any nonprofits that were currently exceeding 5 events a year with alcohol. I'm just curious, I guess, about how often that's happening. I don't want to cause competition problems for the private sector, but I also don't want to take away a source of fundraising for nonprofits.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, through the chair. I don't know of any that are having more than 5. 5 is current law, so if they are, they're breaking the law. So I don't know of anyone that's doing that. I've been involved with some nonprofits that have had fundraising events, and I know when they went from catering to non-catering, I remember that year, and it got a little different because they weren't used to doing it, so it wasn't quite as smooth. That being said, they got to keep all the sales from the event, so that helped their nonprofit. But they didn't do, they did one a year. They did their big fundraiser party one a year, maybe 2, but not 5, and definitely not 10.
Senator Machicki.
I can wait, Madam Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just gonna ask a follow-up, actually, of Senator Machicki. If during the process, was it raised as an issue by nonprofits that they would like the ability to do 10? Where did we arrive at that number?
So one organization was the Friday, there's in Anchorage. First Friday event, that would be more than five a year. There's other community events like that. But I feel like I have to clarify something. Nobody in Alaska is required to have liability insurance under state law for alcohol. A licensee can choose to have insurance, but no one is required to. However, typically what groups do when they have an event is one time alcohol liability insurance is relatively inexpensive. So for some of the events I've been involved in, we purchased that one time alcohol liability, not required under state law for any licensee or any other type of event.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen, anything further?
No, thanks, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion on Amendment 19 as amended? Representative LeBon.
And just real quick, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would think the nonprofit community would want to default to a professional with alcohol involved and utilize a license that's available with the insurance coverage in place and the liability protection. I'm finding this reasonable at five. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Hearing none, Representative Wohl, wrap up on Amendment 19 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think everything's kind of been said about it. I guess I do remember the law that doesn't require liquor liability, and I remember I probably went a little bit without it and was advised that's a bad idea in case something happens. And fortunately, my 25-plus years, nothing ever happened. But better safe than sorry. I think five events is plenty per year to do on your own if you go above and beyond that. I understand First Friday, I had a friend with an art gallery back in the day, and they used to just let you bring a couple bottles in, have a little wine sampling and some cheese and crackers, and then the ABC cracked down on that and said, hey, you got to get someone with a catering permit and do all this. And he said it's not worth it, so he stopped doing it. This would also still require a special event permit and selling of alcohol, which this individual didn't want to do. So, but I think five a year is plenty. I understand First Friday, but that's all.
Thank you, Representative Wohl.
Can we take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. House Finance on the record. That takes us to Amendment 19 as amended. I will withdraw my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, Amendment 19 as amended has been adopted. Representative Wohl, I believe you have multiple amendments that you're going to withdraw.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, I will withdraw the remainder of my amendments, and I will list them by number. Amendment number 3, I'll withdraw. Amendment number 4, amendment number 5, Amendment Number 6, Amendment Number 7, Amendment Number 8, Amendment Number 9, Amendment Number 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 20, 21. And what else do I have? Is that it? 20, 24, and that's it for me, I believe.
Great, thank you. The referenced amendments have been withdrawn. This will take us to Amendment 26, and with that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 3:20 p.m. We are going to move to Amendment 26A by Representative Carpenter. Representative Carpenter, do you have a motion? I'll object for discussion. Representative Carpenter.
Adds the words an existing brewery retail license under AS0409320, an existing winery retail license under AS0409330, or an existing distillery retail license under AS0409340. So the language of the bill would then be the intent here, or the effect would be that the board may allow the relocation of an existing dispensary license, and then it's adding these three categories into the language of the bill. And I will leave it at that.
Further discussion, Representative Josephson.
Yes, I'm tempted to ask Senator Machicki, with a Kenai Peninsula hypothetical, just so I understand. I'm trying to think here about, for example, like some late law.
Okay, so this is designed to solve a problem for that a member brought to me about their community, which is similar in some of our communities. Not a liquor license, but a restaurant and eating place and a brewery, if this were to pass, a brewery retail license, existing winery retail license, or existing distillery. So they would apply for a license and then could move it into a city. So essentially what you're able to do, a lot of the cities would be limited at 1 in 9,000 now, since the bill's been changed, if it, the final passage is that number. If you were at 8,999 and you wanted to have another license, you can borrow population from the borough to move something into the city. So the member was concerned that there's obviously most of the commerce occurs in a place that may be population cap limited. We attach this to the municipal request that they be able to move licenses from the less densely populated borough into a city for an REPL, where my suggestion was adding the brewery, distillery, and brewery and distillery licenses into a city as well. So it solves that problem for cities that may eventually cap out but have a large population in a borough that's not in that city. The borough would likely still have room for other licensees outside. And the First Amendment, which I guess it's okay to talk about, just simply made an ask to the ABC board for consideration of new licenses. This is actually a program where they would award the licensee the ability to move. It's not a petition process. It's a process that allows them to use those numbers outside of a borough to bring something into a city.
Representative Josephson.
So, this needs your approval?
It does. It's always been about finding solutions to reasonable, when someone's brought a kind of a reasonable request, is how do we do this? We thought about it, and the other one with the REPLs, I think potentially someday in the future, when everyone stops worrying about their businesses being shut down because of competition and folks realize that a rising tide floats all boats, that may potentially expand in another bill. The other amendment essentially had the potential to deal out licenses of all types all over the state, whether they had police protection or not. This doesn't do that. You would have police protection in the cities. You can move it into where that already exists. I'm in support of this amendment if it were to pass.
Yes, Representative Josephson.
Wouldn't the group amongst the stakeholders that have concern be the recovery group? Wouldn't they think this is just an end run around? Of course, it's going to have some built-in limitations. But around the population limit, it just strikes me that they may not like that.
So I understand, Representative Josephson, through the chair, it's so hard to remember sometimes. This doesn't add new licenses, it relocates licenses. So that population was already there. They were very worried about the other amendment that had the potential to add hundreds of licenses around the state. This doesn't add new licenses population on a population basis. It allows the borough's population to be considered. So those facilities might be out there anyway. This allows them to relocate to the center of commerce, which admittedly is a much healthier place to do business, healthier financially.
Representative Josephson.
But through the chair, under my hypothetical, if Summit Lake Lodge is not an REPL but a DDL, I guess that would qualify under this amendment?
It would not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson and then LeBron. Representative Johnson.
One of these licenses is transferred in from the borough and they do business for 20 years and they decide to sell it. Does it stay inside the municipality or inside the city, or does it revert once you sell it? Does it have anything attached to it, I guess? guess that would be my question. Do these become licenses just on equal par? You can't tell them apart between ones that were originally, you know, I don't know, legitimate, I guess, as opposed to something else? I mean, I know some licenses do change like that.
Senator Michicki.
Yes, Representative Johnson through the chair. I will remind you all once again, I think you're all overly focused on the population caps associated with tasting rooms because of all the other business models we put forth. But if that were the case, it could either stay or it could move back out. But there would likely be still room in the borough if someone chose to create another business with that cap. The 1 in 9,000 now leaves so much more room, but with the ability to go, I just spoke to a tasting room today that is going, if this passes, is going to purchase an REPL, which would create another license. I don't think the population limit is going to be an issue for tasting rooms going forward. But to answer your question directly, it could either stay in the city or move back out to the borough, as long as it doesn't exceed the population cap of the borough.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify that it does, it becomes a full license within the city.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Questions from Representatives LeBon, Wolf, and then Carpenter. Representative LeBon. Representative Carpenter.
So that question was directed to either of us, and I would just like to take a stab at.
Yes, answer. Representative Carpenter.
So I don't read anything in the statute that would prescribe that change is a permanent change. But I do think there is risk that a future would leaders of that those organizations might take a look and say, hey, this is, they'll treat it as a quota, is where I'm getting to. That it was in the borough and now we moved it to the city and therefore it should go back to the borough because it was originally at the borough. I think there is risk that is consideration, but I don't see that it's written that is what the effect will be. I just think that it's possible that people might construe it to be that way.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up comment. In Fairbanks, the Fairbanks North Star Borough has better than twice the population of the city area. So from a business location point of view, any business is going to want to take advantage of where the traffic flow is. And in Fairbanks, there's a steady traffic flow for shopping, for work, for entertainment from the borough into the city. So this is just to give an option for a license to be located near the city or even within the city if the economics and the business opportunity of it makes sense. So that was the purpose of this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Michicki.
My expert advisors make it so I'd better correct the record for Representative Johnson's question. It actually becomes a city license attached to the city. So if someone wanted to move it to outside of the city, they would just apply under the remaining borough's population cap. So that city transfer, when it moves into the city, would remain as a city license instead of a borough license.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to get that on the record because when someone does this kind of business investment, it's important to know what you're dealing with and for them. So that was for a future business owner.
Thank you.
One more correction.
Senator Michicki.
A BDL can already move into a city from the borough under existing law, which is how we kind of borrowed that concept as we were moving through this bill.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was going to bring up that exact point the Senator just brought up. But under existing law, BDLs can be moved across the city borough line. Package stores, this looks like new language, an existing package store license. That's new language to this bill. And now we're adding an existing brewery retail license. So all these other tasting rooms have to be existing already to move from the borough into the city. You can't say, I want to start one in the city. I'm going to move my hypothetical license in. You already have to have it existing in the borough before you can move it in. Is that correct interpretation?
the interpretation is, I'm waiting, because my understanding is the opposite. You can apply in the borough for a city license because you just have to be licensed. You don't have to be operating. So you have to obtain a borough license and then apply to move it into the city. And the package store relocation was in the bill since 2016, so it's not new language in the bill. Sorry, just answering two questions at once.
Representative Wolf.
Yeah, follow-up, thank you. I just see it's in bold, so it's not in current statute, but it's in the bill, and it's, I'm getting a yes. So if someone, for example, we hear about Mat-Su Borough, the city of Wasilla wants to get another package store, under this, they could apply to, if there was one in the borough, they could transfer it into the city. If both the city and the borough approved, and every 10 years, you could move a maximum of three, and the board would have to approve it as well. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that is correct. And that, again, that was us trying to be responsive to communities that would like more flexibility, and some of them would like to do their own licensing of alcohol. We're trying to find that balance that answers some of their needs without just opening the door to an indeterminate amount of future licenses.
Representative Wolf.
Yeah, last question. We often talk about what you just mentioned, a taste room that's going to, when this bill passes, apply for REPL and get a restaurant eating place license and have a new set of rules that they would work under. Their existing tasting room license, that is now for sale. They could sell that to a brewery that wants to get a tasting room or an individual that wants to start up a business. Is that correct? If the community's maxed out and they want to open a new one, they could then, this is a transferable for sale private market entity, correct?
That is correct. They would have two choices, like any license. They could let it go back to the state, depending on whether or not they thought it had any value. I don't think these are going to have value for quite some time, or they could choose to sell it on the open market.
Thank you. Anything further on Amendment 26A? Seeing none, Representative Carpenter and Rappa? With that, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection on Amendment 26A? Hearing none, Amendment 26A has been adopted. That takes us through all of our amendments for Senate Bill 9. As we are over our time today, we will have final wrap-up discussion and a vote on Senate Bill 9 at a future meeting. So thank you, Senator, for coming back this afternoon. We appreciate it. Our agenda has concluded. Our next meeting will be tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We will hear an introduction of House Bill 172, Mental Health Facilities and Meds, by the administration. I'm also going to set an amendment deadlines for House Bill 220, Retirement Systems, and House Bill 289, Marijuana Industry Task Force, will be next Wednesday, April 19th at noon. Again, House Bill 220 and 289, the amendment deadline is next Wednesday, April 19th at noon. And with that, at 3:36 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.